He changed the face of local television sportscasting, and people loved him for it, and hated him too. Born and raised just outside of Chicago, he knew from an early age he wanted to get into sportscasting, so he worked his way up through the ranks quickly, starting out at his high school station, and by the age of 21 was the producer of the Milwaukee Bucks radio broadcast in their NBA championship season. He did it all, including national roller derby broadcasts, and by his mid-20s, he'd landed a job as the lead sports anchor at Wish TV Channel 8 in Indianapolis. He was either a breath of fresh air in a stale media environment or an egomaniac, all depending on your point of view. He brought an element of roller derby and professional wrestling to his job, playing the role of the villain who loved to be booed. He was voted the most popular sportscaster in the city, and the least popular too, which was exactly what he wanted. After 6 years in Indianapolis, he eventually moved back home to Chicago, where at the age of 65, he remains a viable force in the city's broadcasting marketplace. He's an Emmy Award-winning broadcaster, an author, and a memorable figure in two major cities. And he's not slowing down either. Yeah, he's worked in Chicago most of his career, but perhaps his happiest years were just down the road a piece, right here in Indianapolis. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with a man they love to hate, Chet Coppock.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
Well, today's One-on-One episode comes to you over the phone line all the way to Chicago. We're going to talk with a man who is a game changer in local broadcasting, particularly in television, Chet Coppock. Still active in the business after all these years, and it's really quite a story. I think the veteran listeners will have a lot of great memories of Chet, and we'll get into all that. Chet, thank you for doing the show. I know you were raised in Winnetka, Illinois, New Trier High School, born in 1949. I'm curious when the broadcasting bug first struck you, when you first started thinking, hey, that's what I want to do.
Well, Mark, first of all, thank you for having me on board. Indianapolis brings back a lot of great memories for a Chet Coppock. It's kind of interesting, you know, when other young kids wanted to be a policeman, a fireman, a superhero, if you will, I was already bitten by the broadcast bug. And I think that was due in large measure to the fact that Jack Brickhouse, a legendary Hall of Fame broadcaster who's in Cooperstown, who is a member, if I'm not mistaken, of 11 different sports and broadcasting halls of fame, was a very good friend of my father's. And my dad was also close to the late George Halas. So I kind of grew up in an atmosphere where, you know, sports was not by any means suffocating, but very much a part of my life. So, you know, really by the time I was 8 or 9, the old-fashioned story about the kid going back in the backyard and taking out a twig and pretending he's doing play-by-play, or, you know, sitting around with my old portable typewriter, the old Underwood, and pretending I was a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. That was all very much a good part of the growing up experience for a Chet Coppock. So I knew, and it was reflected in my academic work in high school and college, that you know, would have had to be bumped up 3 notches to qualify as mediocre. That really all I ever wanted to do was broadcast, and I've had the good fortune. I mean, this is my 46th year in the business.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So it's been very, very good to me. And ideally, in a perfect world, Mark, the way it all comes, the way it all comes shuffling down, the way it all concludes, would be me saying, all right, good evening, everybody. Only in this case, it would be, all right, good eve, slam, down, head on the desk, game over. And then, but all those people over the years have hated my guts have to come in and talk about what a great guy I was.
That's right. It all changes when somebody dies, doesn't it? Hey, so what did your dad do that allowed you to meet these people?
Well, my dad was a character. He was a bona fide character. He was raised in Detroit, but he came to in 1928, and he enrolled at Northwestern. And while he was there, he met a guy named Luke Johnson, who was a very vibrant, very colorful character. And Luke played for the Bears and then became their offensive coach for, if you can imagine this, almost 30 years, which is just unthinkable. But, I mean, that was the way George Halas and the NFL operated in those days was, you know, it wasn't you have to win 11 or you're out the door. And my dad began to run the chains on the sidelines for the coach. And, you know, Dan, George, and Jack, and these various people who became, you know, part of my young life were very, very close. And Dad made a lot of money and blew a lot of money. He had a knack for being able to come up with a good business and make a few bucks with it. But the lure of Arlington Park and the lure of, you know, Red Label Scotch was never going to stand in the way of my father having a good time. So let's just say he was colorful. He was flamboyant. He was a charmer. And Mark, he was the kind of guy who, if you met and you sat down with him in a bar, you'd want to sit for 5 hours. Great, great storyteller.
Would you say you then grew up middle class? Were there times when you were poor because of, you know, his habits?
Or? Yeah. Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, I grew up initially with really very much a silver spoon. We were members of two very prominent country clubs here in the Chicago area, one being North Shore out in Glenview, and the other being the Chicago Athletic Association, which was very old-fashioned. Women were only allowed on the sixth floor. And I remember about the age of 11, my dad walked in, and I'll never forget this. It almost brings, you know, a sense of real anguish to me, because the look on my father's face was so just so devastated. You know, he walked in and said, "I've had to sell our business." And you know, Dad then spent about a year and a half trying to find out his next gig, his next angle. He tried the restaurant business, and that really would have flourished, but he couldn't get the lease he wanted. But we went, Mark, from living a life that really, I mean, if you can imagine this, in fact, I'm sitting here in my condo right now in the West Loop in Chicago, and you know, if I can give you a little color, I'm gazing at Willis Tower and looking over at the Donald Trump building and looking at the Hancock building, and I really feel very blessed. But you know, when I was young, if you can imagine this, I mean, I, you know, somewhere tucked away in the files, I've got a picture of myself when I'm about 4 years old wearing jersey number 77, which was worn by Red Grange, and I'm standing with Red Grange and with, ironically, Bronco Nagurski. And, you know, Dad had a way of charming people, and he ran with a very, very fast circle of friends. There was a legendary bookstore and magnate here in Chicago, Carl Crock, who owned the Crocks and Brontano's bookstore chains before bookstores became about as successful as the Edsel. But Dad was very charming, but we went from living this really glamorous life where my father would spend a fortune every year just to keep the lawn at our residence looking like the 18th fairway at Augusta, to living, if you can imagine this. And there were just three of us. I was an only child, which, you know, as you go along, you'll figure out that's why I'm so damn neurotic. There were three of us living in a one-bedroom apartment.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it was tough on me, very, very tough on me and very embarrassing for me. But I don't think my dad ever really quite got over that.
Yeah.
That was the one hurdle where he'd always been able to, you know, come back from the left hook and beat the count. But this was like the last time, and he just didn't beat the count. It's very, very sad to watch. I don't think there's anything really on earth, if you have, you know, what I had, and that was, you know, adoration for both of my parents and a great deal of love for both of them. It's very, very difficult to watch them when you realize that they have feet of clay.
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult to go through. And, you know, hey, a lot of people do it. And, you know, I'll be very candid with you. I've been very blessed over the years to make a lot of money in this business. But I hit the wall about 5 or 6 years ago when I made a couple of bad real estate investments down in Florida. and I lost about $600,000. And you know that set me back for a while, and it caused me to, you know, readjust my lifestyle for a while. And you know, fortunately, I'm out from under that. But I know from the standpoint of my own children, who are much older than I was when I went through being shell shocked with my dad, that you know, you see in their face that that something is missing.
Kopic takes off in pursuit of his dreams when One-on-One continues. But first, here's Kopic's colleague at Channel 8, Mike Ahern, recalling his initial impression of the new kid in town.
Well, I was not a big Chet Kopic fan when he arrived. he really broke the mold. Most of the sportscasters around here were doing hits, runs, errors, and how many left on the bases, you know. They do the box scores, and that was pretty much it. Chet was the, I think he was really the first sports personality this town had. Now, of course, it's pretty common for everybody to get their opinion, and the more controversial, the better. But Chet was, he was the first one that really raised eyebrows. He was a kind of a special liking. You had to kind of like what he did and kind of buy into it, which I finally did. And became a big fan, but it was a slow process.
Welcome back to One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with former Channel 8 sports anchor Chet Kopic. His father lost money as quickly as he earned it. And in high school, he was around kids who came from wealthy homes. He decided he wanted to make a lot of money too, so he dove into broadcasting. He was producing Milwaukee Bucks broadcasts by the age of 22 and making good money doing national roller derby telecasts. It wasn't long before his ambition brought him to Indianapolis. Given, you know, your dad's ups and downs, were you a, like, confident, popular kid in high school, or was it the other extreme, or were you just kind of in the middle of all that?
Well, you know, it was funny because I went to Utrecht High School, which was ranked, if I'm not mistaken, the number one or number two public high school in America. There was a lot of money in the high school. It was right along Chicago's North Shore, which encompasses Wilmette, Kenilworth, Winnetka, all very, very, very wealthy suburbs. But I have to tell you, I loved every day I was at New Prairie, and you know, had a ball, and really, you know, got a grip out of being there, and you know, did my first broadcast work on their little FM or 88.1 WNTH, doing football and basketball. So I had a wonderful time in high school, albeit I remember, you know, we used to have what were called advisories, and you were with 25 or 26 boys for, you know, first period advisory for the entire 4 years that you were at New Trier. And it's kind of interesting. My three best friends, I mean, Mark, this is one of those, you know, weird aces over kings type deals you're going to see. My three best friends were three guys named Tom Anderson, Scott Thurber, and Vic Walker. And all three, when they left high school, went on to college, put in their time, and then all did what was tradition at New Trier High School, and that was take over the family business. So, I mean, I was around a lot of money, but that motivated me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was determined that I was going to make money, and I was determined that, you know, I wanted to play on the highest level, and to get there, I was willing to do what I felt had to be done. And, you know, I mean, hell, by the time I was 22, I was producing the Milwaukee Bucks radio network with 55 stations, and the Bucks won the NBA title in 71 on my 23rd birthday. So, you know, I really didn't, it wasn't that I hated academics, it's just that I saw it as being something that I had to endure to eventually be, given a reprieve so I could go about pursuing what I really wanted to do.
Yeah, you knew what you wanted to do all along, so you knew what was important. At that time, like when you're in high school, was your dream to be a radio play-by-play guy or a television anchor man, or, you know, what was it for you?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I had this dream in the back of my mind. I really had two dreams. One was that I would be voice of the Chicago Bears on radio, and that I would eventually, I had this scenario laid out in my mind where Jack would retire in the mid-70s, and by then I'd be in my late 20s, and I would have had, let's say 3 years at Southwest Missouri State or something like that, who knows. But I had that in the back of my mind. And I also wanted to anchor sports at Channel 5 here in Chicago, which is the NBC, now here's the irony. Joe McConnell, who is with your forerunner, OWIBC,
mm-hmm.
was doing the Vikes. This would have been, I believe, the winter of 1977. Joe was doing Minnesota football, doing the Vikes, and he calls me over at Channel 8 and he says, I really need your advice. Jim Finks, who was then general manager of the Bears and one hell of a football man, had called Joe up and offered him the opportunity to become voice of the Bears. He said, what should I do? I said, Joe, it's a no-brainer, for God's sakes. I said, the Minnesota Vikings are a good franchise, but you're talking about George Halas. You're talking about a charter franchise. You're talking about the Chicago Bears. I said, you'll make more dough off the field, hyping cheeseburgers and cottons than you will ever make in Minneapolis doing the Vikes. So, Joe wound up taking the Chicago Bears job. And then the irony of all this, if you start thinking about, being in the right place at the right time, or you start thinking about, remembrances, I was doing, Mark, of all things, a roller derby game.
Yeah.
For the old San Francisco Bay Area Bombers in Fresno, California, on a Friday in 1974, first week of September. Remember it vividly. Got a call from a guy named Dwayne Dow, who had just been blown out in Washington, D.C., going head-to-head against George Michaels and Warner Wolf, which pretty gosh darn formidable competition, if I do say so myself. So I said to Dwayne, you got anything on the back burner? He said, well, there is a station in Indianapolis. I think it's called WIS or something like that. My agent wants me to go, but I don't know. I think I can play at a higher level. Well, at that time, Wish, I don't know what it is now, but Wish was, I think, the nation's 19th largest market. So I said to Dwayne, I said, do you mind if I have my agent call and just check it out? And so anyway, on this Friday night, my agent, a guy named Barry Edwards, called up Wish and got a hold of Lee Giles, the news director, and one of the most underrated broadcasters I've ever met in my life. And they told my guy, we think we're locked in with a guy from South Bend, but if your guy wants to fly in on his own dime, we'll audition him. So after I got done with the roller derby on Sunday, I took a red eye in from Anaheim to Chicago. Zipped over to my apartment, showered, changed clothes, drove down to Indy, auditioned, and I got the job on the spot.
What do you do in an audition like that?
Well, I remember it was kind of funny because Mark, I was a little bit of a character. Remember those old Lincoln Mark IVs, those big long suckers that, diamond in the back, sunroof top, big in the scene with the gangster lean?
Yeah.
I was driving one of those when I was 24 years old. And I pull up and I've got long hair and I'm wearing this red blazer with lapels that were about, 2 feet long. And I walk in the front door and I know Indianapolis is it's a great community, and I have so many friends down there that I just think the world of. But it's also a little bit more conservative than Chicago, for example.
No question.
So I thought to myself, I haven't got a prayer for this. Anyway, I walk in and I meet with Lee, and Lee said, "Here, put together a 5-minute sportscast." So I walked into a room and I dashed off 5 minutes. I didn't want to tell Lee that really, for the most part, I never used a script, that I preferred to and live, but they had me do this, and then Lee said, "Can you wait a few minutes?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." They took me upstairs with Mr. McConnell, Bob McConnell, a wonderful man who appeared to be almost like, you know, a senior vice president of a bank, you know, a blue vested suit, a very conservative man. And we went upstairs, and I remember he, you know, he said, "We think you can work here." And, you know, he said, let's establish money. And, well, in Bob's world, there was no room for negotiation. And at the time, you know, Mark, I'm making about $40,000 a year, and this is in 74 doing the roller derby.
Oh, that's great money.
I mean, my God, you could look like King Farouk, for heaven's sakes. I took the job in Indianapolis for, geez, I want to say $15,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the same week, I also accepted a job with the Bears as their public address announcer. So it was kind of an interesting week for me. But the reason I took the job in Indianapolis, and it was without question the best move I ever made in my life, was because I thought to myself, you know, if you do roller derby too long, you're going to get typecast and you'll always be doing roller derby, which I had no interest in doing. I mean, I said, your goal was always to be legitimate. If you want to work at Channel 5 or you want to work at WCBS in New York or, you know, KNXT in Los Angeles or whatever, you know, this is the way to do it. And I really thought that Indy would be about a 2-year stop. Well, I began on the second Monday of September in 1974 and, you know, fell in love with Mike Ahearn and fell in love with Stan Wood and just loved the environment. And, you know, I was lucky enough that people, you know, bought into my act. And the one thing, Mark, I don't think I've ever told this story to anybody, but the night before I was going to go on the air in Indianapolis, I flipped on 6, I flipped on 8, I flipped on 13. I just kind of went around the board to see, you know, what was going on. And I kind of got the impression that, you know what, this town doesn't have a bad boy.
Yeah.
This town doesn't have somebody you can have a love-hate relationship with. And so I determined that guy was going to be me. Now, if you're going to make a determination like that, two things have to be involved. One is you really can't fake it. I mean, there has to be a part of you, and this probably goes back to my wrestling background, you know, as a young kid working as an advanced man for guys like Dick the Bruiser and Vern Gagne and Bobby Heenan and guys like that. I determined that I was going to be one guy who was going to, you know, step outside of the box. And, you know, third week I was down there, I mean, just a classic story that in many respects I thought was going to get me fired but wound up making me. Indiana was having its annual preseason basketball banquet, I believe at the Columbia Club, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, of course, Bobby Knight was was a guest speaker. Well, I knew a little bit about Bobby Knight. I knew he could coach, and I knew a little bit about Bobby's, you know, volcanic temper. So comes the time that the banquet ends, I just arbitrarily walk up to Bobby. "Hi, Bobby, I'm Chuck Topic with Channel 8. Can I interview you for 5 minutes?" And he just walks right by me. And I go back that night, and I don't even bother to tell the news director. I go on the air, and I say that, you know, I just met a guy who has a public relations tact of a 3-year-old. And his name is Bobby Nagel. Oh my God! I mean, you would have felt that I had declared, you know, pregnancy as being anti-American. I mean, the phones just rang off the hook, but I'll never forget this. You know, Bob McConnell and called me into his office the next day, and the first thing he did was, you know, he read me out. I mean, he read me out, but good. And the reason he did that was he was an Indiana graduate, and I know that he had you know, fellow alums who had called it saying, you know, get rid of this interloper from Chicago. But then Bob said, "You know what, kid? You got him talking already, and that's a good thing." He said, you might want to loosen up on Indiana, but he said, don't change what you're doing, because ultimately it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never forgotten that, never forgotten the moment, never will forget it.
Kopic becomes the most popular sportscaster in Indianapolis, and the least popular, too, when One-on-One continues. But first, here's more from Kopic's colleague at Channel 8, Mike Ahearn.
Chet would always be booed at then Market Square Arena. You know, he'd walk in with his fur coat and his attitude, and he kind of strut in there. And usually he said that boos would come cascading from the stands. And, I don't think that bothered him because that was his persona. That's kind of what his personality was. But I remember one day in the hallway, Chet had a real glum look on his face, and I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "I haven't received one piece of hate mail today." He played that for all it was worth. You know, he knew what his role was. He always called himself the man you love to hate.
Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with former Wish TV sports anchor, Chet Kopick. He came up with a shtick as a sportscaster in Indianapolis, one that worked beautifully for his career. But he wonders now, was it worth the price his family had to pay for his prominence?
Mark, you talk about stupidity. I was doing the Lee Corso show. This had to be, I think, 76. Yeah, that was the first year he beat Alex. I guess he did win the bucket. Well, about four games in, you know, Indiana's been knocked off by Nebraska 115-0, and they get their heads handed to them by Akron or somebody, I don't know. You know, but anyway, they're not playing very good football. But then again, I mean, Lee had no talent whatsoever. And so I'm getting all this mail, and I'm getting all these phone calls from, you know, people who are, you know, all over my case because I'm hosting the Lee Corso show. And I think the world of Lee. In fact, Lee and I had lunch here in Chicago about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I go on the air on a Friday night, and now imagine this: I'm doing my fearless forecast on a Friday night, and I'm just kind of ad libbing, and everything is rocking and rolling and shaking and baking. We're having a good old time, and I go before I get done here, before I make my pick on Indiana against Minnesota, I just want to tell all you people who've been calling me every day or sending me letters every day talking about how rotten Indiana is. I got news for you. God couldn't win with Indiana's offense. That didn't play too well. but all these things did ultimately, Mark, was they created a persona for me where, you know, I'm the only guy who ever enjoyed being booed when he walked into Market Square Arena, because to me that was a very definitive sign that people recognized me.
Absolutely. You always struck me as you're kind of the Gorgeous George of broadcasting. You had
that well said, very
know,
well said.
What you described it yourself as an act, and people, some people probably recognized that and some people didn't, but people enjoyed it, and, you know, it worked for you. You know,
it did. I mean, for example, when Victor the Wrestling Bear came in the first time I was down there, you know, the Pacers called me up and said, you know, would you be willing to wrestle Victor? And I said, well, I've got some conditions. And they said, well, we can't pay anything. I said, no, this doesn't have anything to do with money. I said, I want the right to have a slave girl of my choice who will accompany me onto the mat, and I want to have the right to dress however I want to dress. So I called up Dick Apples, Dick the Bruiser, who lived over on Kessler Boulevard, and I told Dick what I was going to do, and I told Dick what I wanted, and I said, I want a robe, and I want some type of stupid headgear I can wear, and I want a pair of wrestling trunks. And he got all those things for me. And, you know, Mark, when I also insisted upon going last. I didn't want to go on first. I wanted to go on last.
Uh-huh.
And as they brought me out, you know, and Red Porter, and I think Red Porter is still doing the Pacers, isn't he?
No, retired a couple years ago.
Webb actually retired?
Yes, he did, finally. He's no longer the PA announcer.
I can leave a note on LinkedIn tonight about that. But anyway, you know, they introduced me, and I come out to a chorus of boos, and I'm amping and vamping like I'm a WWF. I'm pointing at fans, and the slave girl helps me off with a jacket. And I'd already worked out the deal with a guy who hit me, Victor the Bear. I said, listen, I'll let the bear pin me in about 3 seconds. I said, I'll walk in there, and I said, throw the bear at me, let him pin me, which he did. I got up and then complained about a fast count, and he gave me about 3 or 4 flying mares, and then all the wrestlers who were involved all piled on me, and the crowd loved it.
Sure.
And I ran it on videotape that night, and every, you know, all this stuff is fun, but here's where it becomes a challenge, and here's where it becomes difficult. You know, you eventually get married, and you walk into a joint like St. Elmo's, which is bar none, hands down, take it right to the bank, the greatest steakhouse in America. When you go in there, there was a joint out in Zionsville called the Prime Rib, or Adam's Rib. Right?
Adam's Rib, yeah.
Yeah. You know, when you go out socially or you're in a theater, you have to get used to the fact that some people are going to give you a hard time.
Yeah.
And you can't hit them. You can't really respond, because if you do, you know, then you're a jerk, and they're going to call you a general manager, and he's going to be pissed off, and, you know, I mean, you have to accept them. And I really, she's not my former wife. You know, we were married for 30 years, but I give my wife, who was this little babe from Milwaukee, who came out of very much a blue carpet environment, and she hooked up with me. And I give her a lot of credit, because really wherever I worked, whether it was Indianapolis, Chicago, the time I did TV sports talk in New York back in the 90s, I always kind of played this text bad boy role, and it's hard on those people around you. Like, I don't really know if I was, you know, given my career position today, to do that all over again with my daughter being, in her mid-20s, my son being in his mid-20s, I don't think, Mark, I could do it again, because it's just too rough on the people around you, if you know what I mean.
Sure, because people say things to them. Oh, you're Chet Kopecky?
Oh, yeah. You know, oh, yeah. God, yes.
Yeah.
My daughter in particular has had to endure a lot of that stuff over the years. Unfortunately, you know, she's got pretty strong shoulders, and she's been able to handle it. But you know, let me give you a quick summation of, you know, of where Chet Kopecky is right now. I host Notre Dame football on WLS Radio. Absolutely love the gig. This will be my eighth year. I host the Heritage Series for the Chicago Blackhawks, which involves a lot of appearances with the Bobby Hulls, the Stan Mikitas, the Tony Espositos, people like that, and a lot of events. And I do a lot of commercial work, and I have a website called newsbox.com, which you know, I'm building with two or three of my friends, and you know, we've had pretty good success with it. So over the last three or four years, as I've reached, you know, the magic number of 6'5", I made a decision about three or four years ago that I had worked so many years, you know, working 10, 11, 12-hour days, that I said to myself, I'm willing to do that, but I want to do it on my terms. And what that really meant, Mark, was that I didn't want to do it every day. I mean, when I was at Channel 8, I was in the office every day at 11 o'clock, and I wasn't leaving until 11:30 at night. And, you know, when you're back in your 20s and your 30s, you can do that, but you get to my age, I still could do it. There is no doubt in my mind I could still do it, but it's something that really I don't want to do, because I enjoy the diversity of being able to do a number of things. And people don't, you understand it. I mean, you obviously understand it, but people don't get how hard it is to be on the air and to be fresh every day and to come up with new angles and to say something interesting on those days when, you know, there's absolutely nothing going on.
Yeah.
It's a very challenging racket. And, you know, it's a very competitive racket. When I was down in Indianapolis, there were guys who I just absolutely revered. I adored. I mean, there isn't a thing in the world that I wouldn't do for a guy like Don Fisher. You know, Baker and I, you know, we're never close. And Lamy and I had almost an instant feud with each other because, you know, Bob got to town the same time I did. And, you know, we never really got it on as friends. And that's not the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of the game. It happens everywhere you go. When I worked here in Chicago on the NBC O&O back in the 80s, the two rival sportscasters I was dealing with were Tim Weigel and Johnny Morris, who was a former wide receiver of the Bears. I mean, we hated each other so damn much that we'd be sitting at the same table for a banquet and wouldn't even speak to each other.
In a way, that's good.
A lot of that was based on the fact that I was, I I was and still am the kind of person who enjoys being competitive.
Yeah.
I mean, I like to compete. To me, that's the joy of this business.
Kopic leaves Indy with help from Bob Knight when One-on-One continues. We are back on One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with local broadcasting legend Chet Kopic. His popularity finally reached a point where he was offered a job in Chicago. Problem was, he had a contract with Channel 8, and they wouldn't let him out of it. He stopped showing up for work, creating a standoff that lasted until a guy by the name of Bob Knight intervened on his behalf. How does it come that you leave Indianapolis?
Oh, you know, I got an offer from Channel 5, and here in Chicago, and the rival parties got into a real bloodlust, and I just didn't go on the air.
Uh-huh.
I just stopped showing up, and this was in May of 1980. I just stopped showing up.
They continue to pay you.
Here's where you see the impact of a guy like Bob Knight. In November of that year, it would have been December, rather, I apologize. Bobby called me up and said, listen, you know, seen you in a long time. Why don't you come down and watch a practice and we'll go out and have dinner afterwards? He said, I want to see where you are. And Bobby was aware that Channel 8 and I were feuding, and it was really sad. It was so unnecessary. But, you know, Bobby just said to me, he said, listen, what do you want to do? And I said, Bobby, I want to work in Chicago. I've always dreamed of this particular environment, this station. And he said, okay, well, you know, I said, I don't know if I can help you, you know, but I put in a couple of phone calls and see if I can move the needle for you a little bit. 2 days later, I got my release. And the gist of it was, you know, Bobby called up Bill Stow, our general manager, and I had no doubt that what Bobby said was, if you ever expect to do anything again with me or my basketball program, I would strongly suggest that you let Chet Kopic go. And, you know, Bobby's been a wonderful friend over the years. You know, we played golf together, and I had the pleasure of, you know, dining in his residence in Bloomington, you know, several times. And even his wife, his first wife, Nancy, and my wife, Anna, became pretty good friends. So, you know, I mean, if you want to bum rap or badmouth Bobby Knight, you got the wrong guy, because I absolutely adore the man.
Well, we could, you know, your career in Chicago would be a whole other show, and you've done, you know, you're one of the pioneers of talk radio. You did all kinds of television in Chicago. You talked about doing Notre Dame football, and you've done Bears football. But let's just go to the present tense. You know, you've got a book out, Fat Guys Shouldn't Be Dancing at Halftime.
An irreverent romp through Chicago sports.
You know, I'm sure you've got a lot of stories to tell. Why that title? Where does that title come from?
That actually came from my publisher, Mitch Rogatz at Triumph Books. You know, as I was writing the book, originally what they wanted, Mark, was they wanted a book that was going to go 100 chapters, and it was really 100 things that every Chicago sports fan should see or do. Well, I thought, you know what? What am I going to say? Go to U.S. Cellular Field, go to Cubs Park, go to Soldier Field, go to Harry Carey's restaurant. I said, no, that's just not going to work. So fortunately, you know, Mitchell was a very flexible publisher, and I really made it kind of semi-autobiographical. And it was really, you know, it's just really more like 100 memories that I have of Chicago. Now, there are some things in there that are somewhat insightful about Chicago sports, but the gist of the book that I wanted to write, and I think I did this, the book fortunately got a lot of nice reviews, and I had a wonderful time doing the book tour, the whole nine yards. And it's still fun to have books. You know, I keep a big stack of books in the back of my car, and if I'm going to have, you know, lunch or dinner with somebody I haven't seen in 3 or 4 years, I always give them a couple of books. And you know, it's fun.
So now you've got your website, right?
Yeah. Go to newsnozebox.com.
Yeah, newsbox.
Or you can,
where
yeah,
does that come from? Where does newsbox come from?
Well, you know, my investors and I sat down and we tried to come up with a name, and somehow, you know, newsbox seemed to ring a bell, and we test tested with the all-age demos, and we did all those silly things that back in the day you would just say, hey, that sounds good, go with it. You know, I mean, these days yeah. it has to be tested, you know, before it's viable. And I have my work with the Chicago Blackhawks, which I dearly love. And, you know, I'm out in Grant Park, you know, a month ago after the Blackhawks had won the Stanley Cup, and I'm doing a video and doing interviews for the club. And I remember I'm sitting there and standing next to Bobby Hull, and Bobby's been a friend for a long, long time. And I'm saying to myself, you know what? It's really been a great ride. I mean, if I kick the bucket tonight, you know what? No runs, no hits, no errors. Well, actually, no runs, no hits, about 2,000 errors. But I have enjoyed this business. I don't get it. Why people? I mean, I don't get why people stay in this business if they don't like it. Because if you're going to do it right, you have to really love it. Because they're between program directors and news directors and, you know, between social media, and I'm a social media freak. I mean, I'm on Facebook and Twitter all day long.
Right.
It can really beat you up if you don't love it.
Oh, and no question. Yeah.
Fortunately, I'm as enthused now as I ever have been. I could probably enter into a form of semi-retirement right now if I wanted to. But Mark, you know, if I'm 90 years old, I fully expect to be working.
I was going to ask.
I have no intention of ever retiring.
Well, that's great. That proves you love the job. How many hours a week do you work now on average?
I would imagine about 50 hours a week.
Yeah. And you're 65?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. You're prospering in the digital age. You know, you're doing the social media stuff, and you've got a website, that type of thing. You've adapted to all the changes, and not many guys do that.
Well, you know what? I've had some people who've helped me out. I've had a lot of people along the road who were very, very nice to me. And if I can, I mean, I would feel horribly remiss if I didn't give out Major League shout-outs to Mike Ahearn, Sam Wood, Lee Giles, all the people I work with, Tom Campbell, Scotty Edwards, all the people I work with at Channel 8 in Indianapolis, because I love each and every one of them, and they provided me with, you know, six of the most wonderful years of my life. And there's a lot of Hoosier boy left in this kid, Mark. A lot of Hoosier boy.
One-on-one with Chet Kopic continues in a moment. But first, here's Mike Ahearn looking back on Kopic's career in Indianapolis.
From time to time, somebody will still mention Chet Kopic's name, you know, and it surprises me because it's been years since he's been on the air. But he left a lasting impression, there's no doubt about that.
Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here. You just heard the Chet Kopic story. You know, if you were living in Indianapolis in the 1970s, you no doubt remember him well. He really did change the face of the local sportscasting scene, and no doubt cost one or two guys their jobs because of the way he dominated the ratings for a while. He did have a shtick, no doubt about that, but you probably could tell from this conversation that he's a lot more than that here. He has an in-depth knowledge of sports, a great memory, and a great work ethic too. And you've got to admire the way he's remained relevant in this uncertain digital age of journalism. He's got a website, newsbox.com, N-O-O-Z-E-B-O-X. He works for Notre Dame and the Chicago Blackhawks. He still does a lot of commercial work, and he's got a book out called Fat Guy Shouldn't Be Dancing at Halftime. By the way, I know today's audio quality wasn't the best, but Chet was talking from a cell phone in Chicago, and this was the best we could do. So if you missed any of it, go to the website at 1070thefan.com. click on shows, click on one-on-one, click on the podcast link, and you can hear it all over again. If you'd like to email me, the address is mark@1070thefan.com. And like Chet, I'm on Facebook and Twitter. His Twitter handle is @ChetKopic, while mine is the equally clever @MarkMonteith. I hope you join me next week for yet another spine-tingling conversation with an Indiana sports personality right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.